Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Masonic Effects. It's an absolute pleasure to have you join us again this week. Much has happened around the world, and particularly if we take a moment just to look at it through the lens of masonry. It's always interesting when we attempt this. I kind of think that for some of us, masonry. You know, if I'm conjuring up an image of it in my mind, it's like I feel like it's sometimes like an old man, which I am, sitting around watching an old man with his turntable, listening to playing his collection of vinyl records. Oh, there's better sound reproduction. There's more exquisite contouring of the music. The equipment that is available is exquisite, but he chooses to listen to the crack and scratch of the needle through his vinyl. Perhaps it's only because it's familiar, but perhaps it's also a marker of a time that he doesn't want to forget. We can always think about living in the moment. We particularly, I think, try to emphasize doing the best we can in the situation, and doing it with a sense of understanding, not just bouncing along, but with purpose. And that, as we talk about so many times, raises a lot of questions that we attempt to answer forthrightly and with some energy. Sometimes with more and other times with less, but always with that sense of expectation. And if we, and being practical people, as we like to think, there are times when we can overlook the obviousness of deeper meaning. And I put this to you. I sat with some fellows yesterday, and as I looked around the table, there were people there that wouldn't have struck me as being deep thinkers, but to suggest that they would not have an appreciation that deeper meaning exists in life would be, I think, a mistake. And yet we have a framework around us that helps us develop this point of view, and I think very early on we need to be able to implant or influence people considering the order with this sense of duality, with this sense of the spectrum of life, all things that are old, that are found in old knowledge, so-called old knowledge. It's like old science, is it? I don't know how measure that really. But the it highlights, I think, a course that that opens up a choice for many, many men before they need to adapt. Before they need to adapt, we find ourselves capable and being encouraged to be reflective. Well, that's, I think, what any sensible man does. I don't think anything about masonry is doctrine. You have to act a particular way. You don't. That's your life. But I can say, and you listeners out there will know quite rightly that if there is a reckoning with ourselves, it's about meaning and doing something with purpose. You and I can find friendly mates to sit with us and have a good time. We can become geniuses with a few pints. We can become courageous and smart and all the rest of it. And we can do that in most towns around me on a given night. And to think that I would be investing my time in replicating that, I don't need another version of that. I've been there, done that, sort of in a manner of speaking. I'm looking for something a bit different, a bit more enriching, a bit more, I want to stop and think. I want to hear your ideas. I'm beyond that point of saying, I only need you to enrich my own ego experience. I only need you or anybody to whisper those sweet nothings that I just want to hear because it makes me feel grand or makes me feel so complete. I'm beyond all of that. No, I don't need that anymore. Did I ever? Yeah, probably. No specifics given, but you know what I mean. Do we need more than that? Well, if you're satisfied with that, I think the conversation is going to come to a quicker end than I would like, but it is there to always be. I think this is a sense of curiosity. I can't predict the next moment any better than you or anybody else. It is what comes along. You adapt and you make the best. You make your decisions. Hopefully, we have a sense of ethic that somehow we've picked up, but we might not always understand how we've been influenced or who's influencing. So that, in a way, could leave us, I think you'll agree, could leave us a bit vulnerable to being manipulated. And my goodness, don't people try. Oh, at every level of life, there are those who will be trying to persuade us to fulfill their plan. Mm-hmm. Their expectation. And I live in a materialist culture where the manipulation is, it's easy to think of this manipulation as profiting somebody else in one way or another. And if people didn't do that, I wonder, would they just wandering around the hillsides like a troop of Monty Python actors, little arms and legs flopping? What else would they do if the whole process of domination and profiting, capitalism was more altruistic, was more egalitarian? What would happen to all these folks who have built a whole life, a whole mindset on the correctness of their ability to dominate, their ability? I don't know. No, I truly don't know. maybe Moore's work on Utopia will help us. You know, we're heading toward that dream. Right now, where I am, we're doing some auto correction. Mm-hmm. Because the attitudes around it are different. It's like they are with us when we started early in our days. I doubt that anybody was thinking that Freemasonry was offering up something that would approximate perfection. No, far from it. I think it was much more of a philosopher's discourse, where you're learning and realizing that a large part of coming together is based on communication, how we communicate. So we create this wonderful world of symbolic communication. We had to create that. The things that were created had much more to do with sustainability and transferability. You know, let's say you and I were part of the group or part of the thinking that came up that started to form this idea. And I don't think it just plopped out as a Big Bang idea. It seems to have a shape. And could we say that once we had the idea, then we went and looked for consistencies with history, with philosophy? I tend to think that it would be easier than being ripe with a sense of philosophy and saying now and asking the question, now if we put this all together, what would it look like? I think that would be very, very difficult because, you know, one person, one man would have that idea, but so would the next and the next. I tend to think it was derivative, deductive, I'm sorry, that we had this notion and then looked for the tests. Is this justifiable in philosophical terms? And then examine, you know, does that mean A plus B equals C? Is it that kind of linearity? Well, in the beauty of this mathematics, this calculus, is that it isn't, that it leaves... it addresses the complexity of each one of us, and to call that a mystery, well, my goodness, you know, we have thousands of years of history before us, thousands of years that we knew about, and a lot more that we still don't know about, that would allow us to examine the thinking of those, you know, the geniuses, those men of genius, and those men who had something useful to contribute, something useful to say. And it's always easy when you're examining somebody else's work. I think we can agree. To see somebody creative, well, that's easy for artists, isn't it? And it's easy for the researcher who is looking for a fact that will be quickly absorbed in new calculations, recalibration. The determinist will say, so nothing is certain, so you're just making it up. You know, it's all false. Well, if that's the way you're thinking, then, you know, bless you. There's not an argument to persuade, because in your own intelligence you have found like these perfect intellectual storms. I can we'll be offered a new version of the perfect storm, the perfect reason why we cannot do something or we do not subscribe to an idea based on nothing else but the intelligence, the maybe the rebellious, foolish pride that that wants to dominate, that wants to be correct. And we can go through all kinds of, you know, gymnastics to do that. Now, that's not, I don't think that's pathology. I think that's intelligence. A lesser mind couldn't do that. It would be, I have no interest. An explanation, I don't care. I have no reason to explain myself to anybody. That's a particular mindset. And it may, whether we find that troubling or not, I don't know why we would. But we do, it does seem to, we do chafe when we come up with those kind, that kind of, what do we call it, rigidity. It isn't. If we press ourselves a little bit, just a little bit, we begin to re-examine presumptions. And that's the curious bit, getting to the point where we're re-examining assumptions. And one assumption, for instance, is this sense of black and white, right or wrong, you know, better, best. That's a mindset. I would presume here, because you are students of rhetoric, you can look at the world through the eyes of another person. So look at the world through the eyes of somebody who subscribes to a sense of spectrums, and that where the black and white edges meet, there is something occurring in between. Consider for a moment that everything is, there's a vibration to everything. Well, to put up your hand and say, I don't see it. I don't see things vibrating. Well, we have the tools that allow us to do that now, don't we? To actually see these, the world at an atomic level. And what do we see at that level? You know, we see vibration. We see movement, constant movement, not least of which are the billions of neutrinos blasting through us all wherever we are in the face of the earth. You know what? We develop theory and then a hypothesis. We have developed hypothesis and then we test them and then we develop theory. But nobody is ever saying, that's it. Turn out the lights. There's no more. We can close all the laboratories now. That's it. That's the extent of learning. Because how do you know? How do you know? That's the extent of it. And that's the way that masonry seems to be affecting some people. What if you re-examine your assumptions with these other premises? You don't have to. Nobody's force-feeding you. You're a grown-up. But do the calculation yourself and look at the findings. What do you find? Do you see, you have this mindset that black is black and white is white, right is right and right, and wrong is wrong. Is there any, no, I suggest to you, not me, 5,000 years ago, somebody suggests this and seems to have legitimacy, that there is a spectrum. And that the opposites that we like to plant in our mind, the opposites exist, don't really exist because we don't have any proof of it. We make an assumption and then we fill in the blank. We fill in the blank to complete that assumption. So a different way of thinking about this is in terms of continuums, so that we don't have a polarity. We don't have the world divided and divide and conquer. We have people that are expressing variations of variations. In these arrays, in these spectrums, think of the world. Think of us in this soup. You and I think about the air as nothing. There's nothing there. Well, we know that there is something there. We don't pick it up with our eye, but it is there. And so when we stop and think for a second, we're living in this soupiness of molecules, and we take some in, and we, our organs do some things and extract oxygen from it, and that is enriches blood, and then life goes on. I mean, I get to simplify sometimes, but is there a point? Is that only an idea that works at a high level, or and not at the rest, or is it simply once you know it, examine it, and if it is valid to you, and you begin to look at the world around you that way, the question that I would have for you, would that mean that you would experience less conflict? Would that mean that you would, that people that want to do argue with you would have great difficulty because you wouldn't necessarily, they wouldn't find opposition. They would find, you know, is somebody exploring the vibrations between that continuity, that cohesiveness. So what would the outcome be for you if you thought that vibration makes sense, that fluidity makes sense, that I want to examine. I'll examine for myself whether the polarity exists. And if so, then, and I can read some conclusions by these past experiments. Now, you know, and I know, that it's quite illegitimate to replicate a past experiment. Because it brings the replication brings validation to the work, and that's predicated, I think, on the idea that change is ever present. Just because we think of ourselves pious, and that we're going to get some wonderful outcome. Well, come on, you're going to change the mathematics of the universe. You know, but no. Anyway, we have a good program today. Keep that in mind, that fluidity. And I ask you to, if you're thinking about the program, to, as you think about it, consider the questions that it raises and ask the hardest question. Ask the very difficult question. That will help with the learning. Is there a deeper understanding? There is, if you find it. But does it exist objectively, or is it just subjectively? In other words, being a practical person, does the world only exist in terms of your sensory experience, and anything that you haven't experienced doesn't exist? Oh my. What about beautiful music? Does that exist? Let's see. Thank you. interesting, isn't it? It's interesting that we can, you know, still enjoy the music of somebody that has been passed on. Reminds me, maybe I'll like to do a dedication. I don't think I've ever dedicated a show to anybody. Maybe once before. This is to a very dear friend, an interesting guy, Michael. Michael died yesterday. I still think he died. He became sick and died because he was realizing I was winning the arguments and debate. But I digress. He was a perfect conversationalist. He had opinion. He had a world of fact. Oh, my goodness. He was a lovely and an incredible Masonic historian. And he contributed a great deal to understanding. He pulled information together. It was just a delight listening and talking with the man. He had a wonderful, a very charming sense of humor. So dedicate the program to him. It's the least I can do, don't you think? The program, the commentary today, the practices of masonry, I don't want you to, I'm not proselytizing here. You know, you'll have your own sense of the practice, but I just want to embellish it. This is like twist of lemon in my martini. This is that drop or two of spring water in my single malt. That's all. You, my goodness, no. You. I would never think of adulterating your drinks to my taste. No, of course not. Or if you like afternoon, well, all right. You know, have breakfast in the afternoon, who's to say, but this is similar. Of course you're going to have your own mindset about this. Here, the practices of masonry, I'm quitting. I have not discovered what we set out to learn. Time is up. If we weren't careful with our screening, of course there will be those amongst us who do not have our values, do not share our values. If we weren't diligent, of course, they will miss out on some of the important chapters. If we stop communicating symbolically, we will risk loss of valuable experience and impressions. How would a gentleman receive his lessons? How would a gentleman pass along those learnings? I would hope they would have a gentle encounter, talking, bantering, sharing ideas, eventually effortlessly sliding into meaning. With enough confidence that nobody's going to have a wounded ego, that in fact, we're safe here intellectually. If I had my way, every Mason would have good taste. They would enjoy the arts and take upon themselves the amazement of science, discovering and reveal more of the great unknown. If there is a shared expectation, it is that we preserve and live according to the ancient landmarks. Of course, this wouldn't be possible if they are not taught and learned, understood. Time has been gnawing away at these simple focal points. A squawking chord organ or out-of-tune piano has given way to exquisitely reproduced musical presentations. Idle suppositions are held up against instant validation. My iPhone is smarter than the world. We can do all that and still need an intimate encounter to entertain dialogue, to draw out what meaning we require. If I met an old king with three daughters And he favored the selfish two at the exclusion of the loving third. It still would not match the scholarly critique of Shakespeare's work, King Lear. On occasion, we would benefit from the same latitude unless we are thinking the craft is a calculus that requires the precision of mathematics and philosophy to work it. Would you allow that we might need to see the play repeatedly to learn all that it has to offer? Maybe we agree that each time we bring presence of mind to serious considerations about the human condition. What beckons to us isn't a pressure external, but an internal desire to know. What if there were poets that were were outrageous? What if there were artists that were that had outrageous lifestyles? What does it do to our thinking about their ideas, about their work? Maybe there's a boundary. You know, there's a level. I don't want to know all of the detail because of what I might find. It's not to walk around with a sense of suspicion about everybody. No, I'm not the constable plodding down the street, looking suspiciously at everybody, thinking in his mind, they're all up to some kind of illegal activity, and it's only for me to have evidence to pounce. No, that's not justice. That's paranoia. The poet that I've chosen to, you know, we've had him on the program, we've showcased him before. Love the attention to the detail, eh? Love the attention. And if we were to ever think that deeper meaning doesn't exist, then that person is probably immune to the work of music and poetry and sculpture, you know, artistry and paintings. Even when their child comes home with that, you know, drawing to stick on the fridge door, you know, it's wonderful. And the place of pride, you know, where they're displayed, that's that we have that symbolic communication happening at a very, very young age. And we might not, at first glance, we might not understand what the artist is trying to do or what they've buried in their work. But oftentimes, as we become a little more mature in our questions, there is a fascination. It's like what we see. Here we go again. What we see isn't always what is. You know, my particular background, the way people present, they would hold themselves together, would often be masking some, you know, difficulty, strain, turmoil, inner turmoil. Well, does a person have a right to their privacy about that? Absolutely. Absolutely. But do they have a right to a deeper and better understanding? Absolutely. Absolutely. And to do that, dialogue helps tremendously. It's not, you can sort things out on your own, yes. But the amount of time it takes and the error can be, it's not like somebody gives you the script. Here, you big dummy, you've fallen into these traps, you're experiencing these moods. Here, I'll just give you the self-help version. You follow all of this and life will be wonderful. The sun will shine out of your orifices. No. Life's not like that. No, it requires an authenticity. Yeah, but this guy, this poet, certainly stretched authenticity, didn't he? This is George Gordon Lord Byron. He was born around 1788, and he died in 1824. So he's of that period. He's referred to as that second generation romanticism. Remember, the romantics were talking about nature. You know, they were writing about nature and about the inner experience of nature, things that you and I take for granted and often mock. Oh, that's, you know, that's too feminine. Really? There we go, challenging 5,000 years of understanding just because we're brought up that way. We have this wonderfully expansive culture that's implanted. Byron became one of the more famous, and he had a very colorful private life. Certainly he's controversial. In 1812, significant to Canadians because of a battle, he was in his 20s, he wrote Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. This is where he commented that he woke one morning and found I was famous. Now get this, this is the telling, you know. He was educated at Cambridge, and there was a rule that, on the grounds that you could not keep a pet dog, and it's rumored that he kept a pet bear in his college rooms, tweaking the nose. And after he graduated, he traveled widely and he wrote poems, and he went into significant amounts of debt to support a very extravagant lifestyle. He had various affairs. His marriage broke up. And he fled, get this, he fled to the continent in 1816. So he's getting toward the latter part of his life. And this is where he entered into a ghost story competition that took place, and it resulted in, you remember Mary Shelley and her husband, she wrote, out of that competition, she wrote Frankenstein. Not lightweights at all. These are people that had attention to detail. And when you do that, my goodness, the world is, you're describing the world. You're describing the world in a particular style. And you allow us to look at the world through your eyes. Byron could command lots of money for new installments. He did particularly to this narrative poem, Don Juan, or Don Juan, as they would say. This is about a Lothario and an adventurer. And people looked at it and said, well, Byron's just describing himself there. And it helped, but the money he arrived at from these live presentations helped him get out of debt. And because it was popular. Oh, it was scandalously popular. People hadn't heard things like this before. But you know, the lifestyle catches up to you. You drink and womanize and carry on, and eventually your body wears out, your mind wears out. So he was trying to do something corrective. It's thought. Scandal and profligacy. He traveled to Greece to fight for Greek independence. And then he contracted a fever and he died. He was only 36 years old. The poem I've chosen, this is thought to be Byron's last poem, and it was posthumously published and awarded its rather strainingly obvious title, Love and Death. It reflects his participation in the Greek War of Independence. And he died in the spring of 1824. We're told all occasions, military, political, physical, climactic, and amorous, seem to conspire against him. In the poem, the heroic actions are shattered by a bigger defeat. Byron is in love with his page boy, thought to be Lucas Chandler Tritanos, and the love is unrequited. They don't engage. The physical dangers of the events described seem to be intensified by the lover's gaze. As it goes, I watched thee, are the first words of the first three stanzas. But one of Byron's special gifts was always to write as both romantic and realist. That ability doesn't desert him here. And in particular, the last stanza is painfully effective, a renunciation and a refusal of approbation, blame. But an extra twist of anguish is created in the internal rhyme and the final declaration, to strongly, wrongly, vainly love thee still. Love and death, I watched thee when the foe was at our side, ready to strike at him or thee or me. Were safety hopeless rather than divide? Aught with one love to save love and liberty. I watched thee on the breakers when the rock received our prow and all was storm and fear and bade thee cling to me through every shock. This arm would be my bark or thy thus bear. I watched thee through the fever glazed thine eyes, yielding my couch and stretched me on the ground, when overworn with watching near the rise from thence, if thou an early grave hadst found. The earthquake came and rocked the quivering wall, and men and nature reeled as if with wine. Whom did I seek around the tottering hall? Free thee, whose safety first provide for thine. And when convulsive throes denied my breath, the faintest utterance to my fading thought, to thee, even in the gasp of death, my spirit turned, oftener than it ought. Thus much and more, and yet thou lovest me not, and never wilt. Love dwells not in our will, nor can I blame thee, though it may be my lot to strongly, wrongly, vainly love thee still. Thank you. Beautiful work. Yeah, we should finish that. Leocano's work. Beautiful. Beautiful. I know that, as you know, that we all, members of your lodge or my lodge, we don't approach masonry in the same way. We have our own version, our own sensibility. The history that we encountered today from these early days, 18th century study of the records of the Netherlands, reveal what happens when that small cohort of deeper thinkers begin to settle into the questions that penetrating, provocative thought will present to men with some sense of purpose, some sense of commonality. They find the commonality in what they're doing. And I thought that it was worth taking a look or examining it because of what it tells it, what it may tell. The question to you, do you see it? Do you see the validity? And this is about, we'll just skip over it. In The Hague, there was a Grand Lodge forming with a constitution, but there were English, this is a part of the history of of a petition to Les Bières Amies, and that was considered a bit of a rebel kind of a lodge because they were operating, I think, maybe, and I know this may be overstepping, but perhaps like the early lodges, St. Mary's or Kilwinning, where they had they were authority all their own before a constitution came along. And so thank you very much. You know, that's an interesting proposition, but we have our own ritual. We have our own governance, and thank you. So they needed some persuasion, yeah? This is at a point where these boys were petitioning. They didn't petition the Grand Lodge. They petitioned Les Bières Amies, the lodge. And as we know, I'll only give it to you briefly. We, George Smith, A.B. and lecturer in mathematics, Grand Master of Masons by a constitution granted solely unto us by James Bridges, Duke of Chandos, Earl of Carnarvon, and the ancient and honorable fraternity of free and accepted Masons, being willing and desirous, together with several other worthy brothers, to have a communication and correspondence with your right worshipful lodge. Further, craving your assistance and advice in regard to a derision and misunderstanding between the English and Dutch members of our lodge, the purport of which is, we, the English, provided with the above constitution, actually will not be subservient to either the laws or demands of the present national Grand Master. Neither are we willing to receive a national constitution or be dependent therefrom, which is what our Dutch brothers insist upon. We therefore think proper to establish a lodge entirely English by the name of Concordia, and shall therefore desire, as by these present admittance into your right worshipful fraternity of Masons, and from thence to be favored with your right worshipfuls, wardens, officers, and members' advice, for the promotion and propagation of Masonry, and the craft in general. We therefore salute you by the 3x3. So, in these records, we have come upon the private socialization of middling men of considerable literacy and sophistication who define themselves as inherent adherents of a constitution and laws permitting them to defy other, also self-defined, legitimate authorities. George Smith, for instance, was a teacher of mathematics and Newtonian mechanics. The defiant tone of Smith's letter reveals his own sense of English national identity, one that is now in reaction to the formation of the Grand Lodge of the Netherlands. Like the records of Les Bières Amies, the letter reveals the obsessive Masonic concern for the legitimacy of these private polities, a status achieved only through a social act, but by the recognition accorded a lodge by other lodges. But what if legitimacy were to be denied and recognition withheld? While the brothers of Les Bières Amies refused to follow Smith in his rebellion, they had constitutional and procedural problems of their own with the new National Grand Lodge. At the founding of the first official Dutch lodge in 1735, now note, official, no terms such as national or the nation appear in the records. Until the 1750s, lodges functioned with a remarkable degree of local autonomy. So much, in fact, that when Rousset set up his lodge, he secured its legitimacy through the assistance of a lodge master in the Dutch northern town of Leeuwarden, one of Hendrik Leithiger's sea captains closely involved in the entourage of Prince William V. For reasons that remain unclear, Rousset apparently appealed to the Grand Lodge of Scotland for a constitution for the new Amsterdam Lodge. At least this was Rousset's memory of his lodge's establishment when he was asked about it 20 years later during the process of reconstitution in 1755. And in the same year, another newly established Amsterdam Lodge also appealed to the Grand Lodge of Edinburgh for its constitution. Huh. So, we see this, what do we see? Do we see this question of legitimacy being reexamined? I think it's interesting when we realize that there is a legitimacy, there is a question that can be asked about the source of Masonry. And if you take it a next step, you could begin to question the whole process of legitimacy. Does Masonry come from within, or is it external? Well, I think that's a big question, because yes, it comes from both. Okay. Becoming a Mason is much different than being made a Mason in terms of authority. Anyway, it's just a thought. Well, we're wrapping up the program for the week. Thanks very much for tuning in. I'd like to say thank you and acknowledge some listeners from Ireland and Latvia and the Netherlands, Oman, Iran, Turkey, New Zealand, Ethiopia, South Sudan. It makes me scratch my head too. Eh? The UK, United States, and Canada. We're a curious mixture, eh? A curious mixture. And I would hope that the discussion prompts some questions in your thinking. And probably a lot that I could never even imagine answering. But scratching, we're simply here at Masonic Effects scratching the surface. And sometimes what we scratch off, we see a little nugget of gold underneath. Sometimes it's fool's gold, you know. Sometimes it's a little piece of a diamond showing through. But thank you for joining in and for supporting the program from around the world. I will be with you next week for more jazz and commentary. That is, what can I say? It's just beyond the pale. It'll be something I hope that is relevant to you. I hope you'll take care wherever you are. The world is asking, is repeating some questions, isn't it? Questions that when I was a boy, I had thought that they had been answered by the sacrifice of millions of people, but apparently need to be asked repeatedly. And I hope wherever you are that there is a time when we, in our future, when we will be coming together, not as a collision, but in terms of the mutuality. And I firmly believe that the minority, small groups of people that have amassed power have created an illusion that is falling apart. We're communicating. A lot of anger is coming out. A lot of frustration is coming out. But something else is coming up. A curiosity. and we're adjusting to new communication tools. My goodness, it's just amazing. Anyway, as you adjust, I'll try and adjust, and we'll agree to pick this up in a few days. Commit acts of random Masonic kindness. And the more anonymous, the better. It's a pleasure having you. Bye-bye.